Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Friday, the 5th of July, these are our main stories. Exit polls following Britain's general election suggest a landslide victory for the opposition Labour Party, meaning its leader, Keir Starmer, will become the Prime Minister. It's projected to be the worst ever result for the Conservative Party, which has been in power for the last 14 years. And in other news, President Biden has welcomed an announcement by Israel's Prime Minister that he'll send a negotiating team to resume talks in Qatar aimed at securing the release of hostages held by Hamas in Gaza. And the security forces in Ecuador have rescued 49 people who had been abducted by a criminal gang. Also in this podcast...
Bit disappointed when you come all the way from the UK, one thing you think of coming here to Australia to cuddle a koala.
You can no longer cuddle a koala in Brisbane. We begin with the general election in the United Kingdom.
And as Big Ben strikes 10, the exit poll is predicting a Labour landslide.
Sir Keir Starmer will become Prime Minister with a majority of around 170 seats.
The exit poll predicts that Labour will have captured 410 seats, adding 209. It suggests the Conservatives will have lost 241 MPs, landing on 131.
The main BBC television news in London announced the exit poll as voting closed. So if this poll is borne out, it will be a stunning turnaround in British politics. And after 14 years in government, the Conservatives are on course for their worst ever result. To put it in context, at the last election in 2019, Boris Johnson was elected Prime Minister with an 80-seat Conservative majority, while the Labour Party suffered its worst results since 1935. My colleague Oliver Conway spoke to our political correspondent Rob Watson. So Keir Starmer is going to be Britain's Prime Minister.
Absolutely. It is a Labour landslide. I mean, as you say, it just seems to be a little bit behind what Labour achieved in 1997. But, I mean, this is nothing short of an electoral earthquake. And I say electoral rather than political for the following reason, that a parliament is going to look completely different. The Conservative Party have been pretty much decimated, their worst result since 1906. We'll have this huge Labour presence. But the reason why I'm hesitating to say political earthquake is that the result, astonishing as it is, doesn't seem to be based on a political fault line. I mean, it's not as if there were any great policy differences aired in this election campaign between Conservatives and Labour, whether that's domestic macroeconomic policy, indeed, whether it is foreign policy. I mean, this result seems to be pretty much entirely driven by an intense dislike of the governing Conservative Party. And because the vote on the right in Britain has been split by the arrival of that man, Nigel Farage, and the populist right of centre party that he leads, Reform. But I mean, whatever way you look at it, it is undoubtedly an electoral earthquake. Whether there's going to be a political earthquake that follows it, we're going to see in the coming days, weeks and years.
And how reliable is this exit poll?
It's always been pretty reliable in the past. I mean, they only tend to get a few seats wrong here or there. I mean, they are saying, we were told, we were briefed by those behind the exit poll, that there are some difficulties. So for example, things could be rather close between Labour and the Scottish National Party, the pro-independence party in Scotland, and the pollsters aren't entirely sure about exactly how well Reform is going to do, and that's because they're doing rather well in lots of seats, but they're not quite sure how well. But I mean, we get the general picture, and you know, one shouldn't forget what the big story is tonight. I mean, there's just no doubt about that. You don't need to be the smartest political journalist. It is Labour landslide, Conservative wipeout.
And what do you put that down to?
I put it down to a number of things. So the first thing is that it is the most powerful force in politics, that is gravity, political gravity. So the Conservatives have been in power for 14 years, and no party in Britain had ever won five terms. So if the Conservatives had won, that would have been utterly amazing. But then you have to get into the weeds of what happened during those 14 years. And essentially, during those 14 years, living standards have stagnated. It's one of the worst periods for living standards. If you go back as early as the 19th century, you haven't seen sort of 15, 20 years where living standards have stagnated like this since the Napoleonic Wars, for goodness sake, Oliver. So there's that. And there's also the kind of chaos of it all. I mean, during the last 14 years, regular listeners will know we've had the Brexit referendum, we've had Boris Johnson, we've had five Conservative prime ministers. I mean, I can't recall any period in British politics since 1945 that has been anything like as turbulent as this. And actually, you know, the big question this raises, this result, because if you think about it, it's just, as you were saying earlier, the volatility of it. And we've gone from, in 2019, we were sitting here 5 years ago, right? You were here, we were all here. And we were looking at, wow, there's this amazing majority for Boris Johnson, 80-seat majority, get Brexit done. People were saying he surveys the British political landscape like a colossus. And now here we are with a Labour landslide, which makes you think, you know, there's something going on in Britain. There's something incredibly volatile about the electorate. So you have to ask, well, is this, we calm down, we go back to politics as usual, or is there going to be more of the same?
Yeah, more of the same. What are the challenges facing Sir Keir Starmer if indeed he does become Prime Minister come the morning?
Well, I mean, I guess if you were to articulate the challenge in a way that sort of people, without getting into sort of the policy weeds, you know, one of the reasons why this result has happened is that a lot of people in Britain just feel like the place just isn't working properly, whether it's the hospitals, the roads, the transport, the trains. You don't have to go very far to hear British people saying, God, nothing works anymore. Everything is rubbish. So now, you know, whatever the expectations of the British people are, and we know that they're apathetic about politicians, but I mean, it does rather fall on the Labour government to now say, well, yeah, we heard that you think nothing works. I mean, I think there will be a certain expectation that Labour are going to have to make it work. And it's not going to be easy because, you know, they have inherited a situation where the British economy has been growing incredibly slowly for a decade or so, pretty much like most other Western European countries. The problem that raises then is, you know, when people say, oh, nothing works anymore, that tends to mean, you know, the government having to spend more money on trains, hospitals, education and everything else. But the government isn't getting the kind of revenues to spend. So that's the dilemma that it faces. You've got this expectation. We want things to start working again. Well, how do you get things working again normally? You know, with patience, economic growth and spending more money, quite often is the case. And all of those things look incredibly difficult.
That was Rob Watson. As part of our election coverage, Valerie Sanderson travelled to the Scottish city of Glasgow, where the exit polls suggest a dramatic result.
Well, I can tell you that the exit polls are suggesting that the Scottish National Party is down to just 10 seats. That's from 48. But we think we're in for an interesting night because we're hearing that quite a few seats are still too close to call. So let me give you the big picture. After boundary changes, there are 57 constituencies here in Scotland up for grabs. Now, that's down from 59 at the last general election in 2019. Now, Scotland is different from the rest of the UK. Not one seat here is a battle between the Conservative and Labour parties. Instead of the domination of those parties, here there is the SNP, and the clue is in the name. The SNP, of course, is the Scottish National Party, which wants independence for Scotland from the rest of the UK. And the SNP has been in power here for the last 17 years. Well, in the last general election in 2019, the SNP won 48 seats, the Conservatives 6, the Liberal Democrats 2, and the Labour Party, which had been dominant before that, won just one seat. So let me explain. There are three main battlegrounds. There's the SNP versus Labour, particularly across the Central Belt. Well, I'm in Glasgow beside the River Clyde, and the Central Belt, it stretches across from Glasgow here in the west to Edinburgh in the east. 3.5 million people live here. That's most of the population of Scotland. They're mainly urban voters, many of them working class. And Glasgow itself, with 6 seats, is a big prize. all are currently SNP seats, with Labour trying to dislodge the incumbents. Now, elsewhere in the country, the Conservatives are trying to hold on to the constituencies they have in the North East. And also south from me, where I am in Glasgow, along the border with England, there is also a tussle between the SNP and the Liberal Democrats. That's concentrated on half a dozen seats, including Orkney and Shetlands, way off the northeast coast of Scotland. And, of course, in the Highlands to the north of me. They are more rural constituencies where farming and tourism are strong industries. That's the picture.
And what are the big issues, Ben?
Well, Jackie, the issue of independence isn't going away. The referendum, you may remember back in 2014, that was where the no voters, who wanted to stay within the UK, they made up 55% of the vote to the 45% who wanted to leave. But since then, the polls have shown the country is pretty well split down the middle, about 50-50 on the idea of going it alone. But in this election, independence has not been the top priority. Scottish voters, and I've been talking to a lot of them today out in Glasgow, I think they've been reflecting the views of the rest of the UK. People have been worried about the cost of living, you know, the price of food and energy. They've been saying to me, you know, they just don't have enough money. They're also worried about the National Health Service, housing and transport. But here again, Scotland is different because it has a devolved government. That's at Holyrood in Edinburgh, which has quite a lot of power over these day-to-day issues. But of course, Westminster, the bottom line is, Westminster has the money and it distributes it, even if whoever's in power here, currently the SNP, has a lot of leeway about what exactly to do with it. And of course, Westminster is also in charge overall of defence, immigration, welfare and foreign affairs. But I would say this election is about who runs Scotland from within. The SNP, as I said, has been in charge for 17 years since 2007. And it's also about Scotland's relationship with the rest of the UK, where, of course, there's been a Conservative government for the past 14 years and which many people feel does not serve Scottish interests.
That was Valerie Sanderson in Scotland. Well, Professor Sir John Curtis is the BBC's polling expert and Professor of Politics at the University of Strathclyde. So what are his thoughts on the exit poll?
The crucial thing, first of all, you need to realise is that this seat forecast is not just simply a consequence of the national shares of the vote that we expect the parties to gain, but rather how they are distributed geographically and how that has moved decisively against the Conservatives. So, for example, support for the Conservatives is falling much more heavily in places where they are trying to defend a seat than it is in places that Labour already hold. But why is that happening? It's not because Labour are doing spectacularly better in Conservative-held seats. It's because Reform are. Much of the damage to the Conservative Party tonight is being done by Reform, even if it is the Labour Party that proves to be the beneficiary. That point two, then, however, the second thing that's making life difficult for the Conservatives is where are Labour doing best? Well, they're doing better in places where they're starting off second to the Conservatives. Oh, and by the way, also places they also seem to be doing quite well in the battle with the SNP, which I'll come back to that. But equally, why is the Liberal Democrat figure so high? It's not because we're anticipating some spectacular rise in Liberal Democrat support, but rather that Ed Davies' hopes of doing particularly well in seats where the Liberal Democrats are the challengers to the Conservatives, it looks as though that hope is going to be realised. So there are two things that flow from that. First, an obvious health warning. While we are pretty convinced that this pattern will exist by the end of the night, whether we've got it exactly right is much more uncertain. Whether we've slightly overestimated or underestimated these patterns could make quite a lot of difference to the seat outcome. The second thing that flows from this is that although this looks like an election in which Labour are going to get a landslide in terms of seats, it does not follow. I will repeat, it does not follow that this necessarily means that Labour have got a landslide in terms of votes. So that's point number one about the broad picture we're presenting this exit poll, the health warning that goes with the estimate, but also the implications for how we might end up interpreting this result at the end of the night. There are then two other things to say. The two figures that I think has probably caused most surprise, most discussion, perhaps most controversy, are one, Reform at 13, and two, the SNP at 10. Those are the two figures about which we are least certain. Basically, what we have got in the exit poll is a lot of places where there is a small chance that Reform will win the seat. But we're talking about 20, 30% chance. And the question, and you know, we add up these probabilities, and that's how we get to the figure of 13. But to be honest, the figure could end up being quite a lot less than that, or indeed rather more, just depending on how the cookie crumbles. And meanwhile, equally, it's already been emphasising from the beginning of the night, inevitably we have fewer sampling points in Scotland than elsewhere. It does look as though the SNP have done particularly badly. But remember, there are lots of seats in Scotland which are marginal between Labour and the SNP. And we have just, if we've just underestimated the SNP's performance relative to Labour by a little bit, then that SNP number will go up. So those are the health warnings. Of course, behind all of this, it does look as though, yep, Sir Keir Starmer is going to be the Prime Minister tomorrow. He's probably going to have a very substantial overall majority. And that, of course, is the crucial thing we're trying to find out. But there is still inevitably plenty of uncertainty in an election, which in many ways looks as though we're going to come up with all sorts of historical records in terms of shares, seats, and also the change in the geography of support. This is, in a sense, is going to be one of the most interesting and unprecedented elections in British cephalological history.
That was the BBC's polling expert, Professor Sir John Curtis. In other news, the French Interior Ministry says it will deploy 30,000 police officers on the streets on Sunday evening because of fears that the result of the second round of a parliamentary election there could lead to violence. Three candidates have reported being attacked while out campaigning. The Prime Minister Gabriel Attal said that violence and intimidation have no place in French democracy. Our correspondent Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
Prisca Thévenot, whose spokeswoman for the Attal government, was putting up posters with two colleagues in the Paris suburb of Meudon, where she's a candidate. When a young local started to deface one of the posters, they protested, at which point a gang of his friends arrived and violently assaulted them. Ms. Thévenot was unhurt, but the other two were hospitalised, one with a broken jaw. Prime Minister Gabriel Attal was in Meudon to lend support to his government colleague.
On peut être en désaccord.
Of course, there are opposing views in a democracy, but it is unacceptable to use verbal or physical attacks, as unfortunately has been the case in this campaign. You will always find me on the side of those who seek to conciliate and to unite, rather than to divide and fuel hatred.
Two other incidents have been reported in the eastern Savoie region. A candidate for the National Rally was assaulted while canvassing in a market. And in Grenoble, a 67-year-old handing out leaflets for a pro-Macron candidate was punched in the face by somebody from the far left. It's a tense campaign, and the authorities are worried about it getting tenser. Police will be on standby in Paris and many other cities when the results come in on Sunday evening.
Hugh Schofield in France. In what could be a significant step towards a ceasefire in Gaza, Israel has announced it will now resume talks with Hamas in Qatar. The news was welcomed by the US President Joe Biden, who has spoken directly by telephone to the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Here's our US State Department correspondent Tom Bateman.
A phone call between President Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu is significant. It shows that there is progress in this. They talk relatively infrequently. I think the critical moment was yesterday, where we got a statement from Hamas saying that they had responded, in their words, positively to the American-backed proposal, reiterating that they want to see a withdrawal of Israeli forces from Rafah in the south, from the so-called Philadelphia corridor, this area on the border between Gaza and Egypt. And then we had today an announcement from the Israelis about sending David Barnea, the director of Mossad, and other officials back to Doha. Now, the phone call between Mr. Biden and Mr. Netanyahu, around 30 minutes. Now, my sense is, from a senior administration official, that this was very much about the nuts and bolts of implementation of this deal. The sticking point has always been that the American-backed proposal had been in phases. The first phase, a temporary ceasefire in return for the release of the elderly and wounded hostages, and also the release of Palestinian prisoners by the Israelis, moving to a second phase. But that second phase will be subject to a negotiation that carries on during phase one. And then you would get a permanent ceasefire, an end to the war, and a full withdrawal of Israeli forces. Now, that has always been the point that Hamas objected to. They said from the start, effectively, you have an end to the war, permanent ceasefire, withdrawal of Israeli forces. My sense is, from what the Americans are saying now, is that Hamas have conceded on that. They would now accept, in effect, a negotiation, a sort of phase into full Israeli withdrawal, permanent end to the war. So that does feel like a breakthrough. But it is only a breakthrough, remember, on getting mediated talks back up and running between the Israelis and Hamas in Doha. So that looks like it's going to happen probably within the next few days. But we're still talking, you know, really about weeks until anything is signed, you know, until these two sides start any kind of truce in return for release of hostages.
Tom Bateman in Washington. Still to come.
One thing is clear, and that is that Chinese electric car manufacturers are able to produce electric cars much more cheaply than their European counterparts.
The European Union confirms heavy punitive tariffs on imports of Chinese-made electric cars. The security forces in Ecuador say they've rescued 49 people who were kidnapped by the Los Lobos criminal gang, which is involved in drug trafficking, extortion and illegal mining activities. They were being held in one of the country's main gold mining areas in Azuay province. Five bodies were found at the site. Police and soldiers say two suspects were arrested after a shootout and many weapons were seized. Rachel Wright asked our America's regional editor Leonardo Rocha for more on what happened.
It was an overnight operation in this important mining area of Ecuador, the province of Azuay. And apparently the police and soldiers also were involved. They were tipped off by relatives that had told that these people working there, being in a mine that was controlled by Los Lobos, one probably the country's biggest criminal gang. And the police said when they approached, they were met by fierce resistance. It's about 20 people firing at them, and two of them were arrested. And then they seized lots of weapons, including dynamite sticks. And that just sheds the light on the level of criminal activity in Ecuador, especially involving a new sector, which is the mining sector.
Yes. So tell us more about this crime wave in Ecuador. How long has it been going on for?
Well, it's basically since the pandemic, the COVID pandemic. Before that, Ecuador was one of the most peaceful countries in Latin America. It doesn't produce drugs or not much. Most of the cocaine in the world is produced in neighboring countries, Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia. And Mexican gangs saw that as basically a gap, an opportunity for them to move in, and they made deals with local gangs. I mean, this Los Lobos, this gang, they are linked to the New Generation cartel from Mexico. And they just went in, and now Ecuador has become a major hub for drug trafficking and other criminal activities. And this particular incident is at the tip of the iceberg because it shows the increasing involvement of the gangs in mining, especially gold mining. What probably happened to these 49 people, and there were five bodies that were found in this mining area, what probably happened to them is the gangs came in and basically forced them to work for them for very little, as slaves or and then it's happened a lot. I mean, there are dozens of mines that are controlled by gangs, and not only in Ecuador, but also in Peru, in Venezuela. There's a big criminal gang from Venezuela specializing in mining, and especially gold mining, because they melt down this gold into gold bars. And they can not only profit from that, but also to launder all the money that they make illegally. So it's a big problem for Ecuador. And the new president, who's been in power for less than a year, has been trying to deal with that. But it's very difficult.
Leonardo Rocha. The European Commission has confirmed it will impose a significant increase in import taxes on electric vehicles brought into the EU from China. Starting on Friday, the tariffs will initially be imposed for 4 months, after which member states will vote on whether to make them permanent. The EU believes that China's electric vehicle industry receives significant state subsidies and so is unfair. China denies this and has threatened retaliation. Some German car makers, particularly those with big manufacturing facilities in China, are opposed to the tariffs. James Menendez heard more from our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
One thing is clear, and that is that Chinese electric car manufacturers are able to produce electric cars much more cheaply than their European counterparts. And studies by UBS, the bank, for example, have put that gap at around 25% to 30%. So it is clear that these cars can be made cheaply. There are concerns then that what the European Union will see is a wave of Chinese manufacturers dumping electric cars onto European markets, trying to get market share and driving existing manufacturers out of what is expected to be a growing market as petrol and diesel cars are phased out and electric cars become the norm. Now, the European Commission began investigating this last year and has provisionally concluded that these manufacturers are in receipt of a lot of government subsidies and that therefore they're able to sell cars cheaply because they've got government support, and that is unfair. So the idea behind the tariffs is to redress that balance. And the tariffs will range from 17.4% for BYD, one of the up-and-coming electric car makers, to 37.6% for SAIC, which owns famous brands such as MG. And that's on top of an existing 10% tariff. So the maximum tariff is, you know, nearly 48%.
Which is extraordinarily high. Why then are some European car manufacturers, some of the big ones, opposed to this?
Well, because they're global players and they believe that ultimately this is not a path they want to go down and it could be damaging to them. Take BMW, for example. It builds cars in China and imports them into the EU for sale to European buyers. It does this because it knows there are cost advantages from producing cars in China. It's going to be hit by the increased tariffs. And it also sells cars going the other way. It makes high-value cars that are sold on the Chinese market, where they're very popular. It's a big market for them. And those cars would be exposed to any sort of retaliation introduced by Beijing. So BMW, and it's not the only European manufacturer, thinks that this is a bad path to go down, that while it might protect some European businesses, there are also risks for the more globalised ones. And Mercedes-Benz is in a similar position. Stellantis has also stated, or the head of Stellantis has also stated, he thinks that it's not a great idea to go down this path. So although it's there to protect European manufacturers and it's designed to redress the balance and make the market fairer, it's fair to say that there's division between German manufacturers, the German government, and French manufacturers principally, and the French government over how you deal with this. So the EU has pressed ahead with its policy, but it's fair to say there's a fair amount of opposition to it.
Theo Leggett. A decision by a wildlife park in Australia to stop visitors cuddling its koalas has prompted a mixed reaction. The Lone Pine Sanctuary in Brisbane will instead allow people to watch the animals in their natural habitat. The move has been welcomed by some, but not everyone's happy. Our Asia regional editor, Mickey Bristow, reports.
Vladimir Putin, Taylor Swift and Roger Federer have all done it. Had their photos taken while cuddling a koala at the Lone Pine Sanctuary in Brisbane, Australia. But the must-do tourist experience is now no more. The sanctuary has decided to ban hugs with the cute furry marsupials. The park's boss, Lyndon Discom, told Australia's Nine News why.
We've received a lot of feedback from our visitors that they want a more immersive experience and they want to have an educational experience. So you get more time with the koala, you get to get up close and personal with it. You get to talk to our magnificent keepers and get to understand more about this iconic species that Australia has.
That up close and personal experience means tourists will still be able to pat the koalas. But some park visitors told Nine News they felt let down.
A bit disappointed. When you come all the way from the UK, one thing you think of coming here to Australia to cuddle a koala.
Came today to take my kids and, yeah, a little bit sad, but I totally understand it's better for the koalas.
I wanted to take some memories with it, holding it.
Koalas are under threat in Australia as their habitats are destroyed. There are perhaps just 60,000 in the entire country. In several states, holding one is already illegal. Some animal rights organisations think harmful human interactions with koalas should be banned everywhere and have welcomed the no-hugs policy. In one park at least, this unique and endangered creature will now be free from the grasping hands of politicians, celebrities and hordes of adoring tourists.
That was Mickey Bristow. And we return to our main story. The Labour Party is predicted to have won a landslide victory in the British general election. Exit polls project that it will have a majority of about 170 seats, with the Conservative vote crumbling and the political career of several cabinet ministers in jeopardy. If confirmed, the result will be a triumph for Keir Starmer, the man who will be Britain's next Prime Minister. Oliver Conway spoke to our political correspondent Rob Watson again.
I think it's probably the second biggest majority in 100 years. I mean, it really is pretty astonishing. But I have to say, the deputy leader of the Labour Party, Angela Rayner, is still being somewhat cautious.
Well, if you look at where we were in 2019, just to get a majority of one, we'd have had to have a swing greater than Tony Blair's in 1997. So we know a number of seats were on a knife edge from our own data. But I also know that all of our activists and our candidates have been going out there, not taking anything for granted, and speaking to the electorate about what they believe matters to them and the concerns that they've had. And I think that the thing that kept coming back to us was that the 14 years the Tories have been in power and the chaos that they've had to tolerate is that they wanted that change. And to bring about that change that they're desperate for would be an absolute privilege for me. But I'm not counting my chickens until we've got those results coming in.
Well, they'll be coming in soon. That was Angela Rayner, deputy leader of the Labour Party. And it is astonishing the turnaround that's happening. 5 years ago, the opposition Labour Party was on its knees. And we're now looking at an entirely new era in British politics. Extraordinary.
Let's look at the Conservatives. 5 years ago, 365 seats. This time, if the poll's correct, 131.
Yes, and that would be their worst performance since, wait for it, drumroll, 1906. I mean, before the First World War. I mean, that is the worst performance ever since the reform of Parliament in 1832. So, you know, this is a political earthquake. I mean, what on earth the Conservatives do with themselves after such a thumping defeat? I mean, the most almighty battle is now about to break out. Where did it all go wrong? What could we have done differently? Was it something to do with the campaign? Was it something to do with Rishi Sunak, who's come in for much criticism? I think the biggest problem they've been up against is their internal divisions, their 14 years in power, and essentially the fact that living standards have stagnated along with all sorts of political turmoil that I think have frankly exhausted the electorate. But don't be any doubt, and I think Angela Rayner knew this with her tone, you know, this is about conservative unpopularity, not any great love for Labour.
Yeah, let's look at a couple of the other results. We dealt with the Scottish National Party with Val a little earlier. The Liberal Democrats, who, of course, were in government in coalition in 2010, then did very badly in 2015. They've had a huge recovery, up to 61 seats.
They have indeed. And that would suggest that maybe the electorate is beginning to forgive them a little bit for going into coalition with the Conservatives. But again, I suspect that a lot of the reason they've done so well is that they have targeted seats where they were second to the Conservatives. And you've probably seen an awful lot of tactical voting, because, you know, one hates to sound like a broken record, but this whole election, these results are about voters thinking, what would be the best way of giving the Conservative Party a kicking? And the Liberal Democrats have been the beneficiaries of that, as have Labour.
And one other party that also could have benefited is Reform.
Yes, and that's where there is some uncertainty. I mean, I think there's no doubt that that was the biggest development during an otherwise utterly stupefyingly dull election campaign, was when Nigel Farage stepped out of retirement, the arch-Brexiteer, to mix it up and lead Reform. And he is, you know, he's very charismatic. Quite a lot of British people like him. And I think that is what's caused chaos for the Conservatives. And it may be that they would get as many as 13 seats, maybe fewer, maybe more. I mean, who knows? But it's obviously been profoundly disruptive.
One of which could be Nigel Farage himself, at the eighth time of asking.
Yes, nobody could say that Mr. Farage hadn't given it a good go to try and become an MP. I've covered quite a few of his campaigns over the last 10, 15 years. So, we'll see whether he does. But, I mean, just like he changed British politics by making Brexit possible, he's obviously really done for the Conservatives, a man of some consequence.
Rob Watson. And that's it from us for now. But you might have heard there's an election count going on here right now. So we will have a special bonus edition a little later, as soon as we have something more solid to tell you. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Johnny Hall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard. And until next time, goodbye.